Indeed, I think that some who have conquered us inflict it upon their captives not out of hatred, but because they want to see a marvelous spectacle. Whether there really exist men who believe that the only evil for them is being forced to act or to say a word against their own laws. And one should not be surprised that we are braver in facing death for our laws than everyone else. For even the easiest of our practices, others do not readily endure. I mean working with our own hands, frugality in food, never eating or drinking at random, or as each man's appetite happens to prompt, never indulging in casual intercourse or extravagance, and again, submitting to a fixed, unshakable order, even in leisure. But those who close with the sword and rout the enemy at the first charge have not been able to look steadily at our rules concerning diet. We, on the other hand, precisely from our willing obedience to the law in these matters, are able to display our nobility there as well. Then men like Lysimachus and Molon and other such writers, discredited sophists, deceivers of the young, revile us as the basest of all men. For my part, I would not wish to examine the customs of others, for it is our ancestral practice to guard our own, not to accuse those of other peoples. As for mocking or blaspheming the gods recognized by others, our lawgiver has expressly forbidden this to us, out of respect for the very word God. But since our accusers think to refute us by comparison, it is not possible to remain silent, especially since the case is about to be judged not by us as its present composers, but by many others who have already made it, and with great acclaim. For which of those admired among the Greeks for wisdom has not censured both the most illustrious poets and the most trusted lawgivers? Because from the beginning they sowed such opinions about the gods among the masses, declaring them to be as numerous as they themselves wished, born from one another and coming to be by every kind of generation, and dividing them, moreover, by places and modes of living, just as the species of animals are divided. Some beneath the earth, some in the sea, and the oldest of them chained in Tartarus. While to those to whom they assigned heaven they set over them one who was a father in name, but indeed a tyrant and a master. And because of this, a conspiracy formed against him by his wife, his brother, and his daughter, whom he had begot out of his own head, so that they might seize and imprison him, just as he himself had done to his own father. Men of superior judgment rightly find these tales worthy of much censure. And besides this, they mock the idea that among the gods some must be beardless boys and others bearded elders, and that others are assigned to particular crafts. One at the forge, another weaving, another making war and fighting among men, others playing the lyre or delighting in archery. And then that quarrels and rivalries over human beings arise among them, to the point not only of raising hands against one another, but of being wounded by men and crying out in pain. And most shameless of all, how is it not absurd to attach to almost all of them, male and female gods alike, unrestrained lust in their unions and love affairs? Then the noblest of them, the father himself first of all, looks on while the women he has seduced and made pregnant are imprisoned or drowned, unable even to save his own offspring, mastered as he is by fate, nor can he endure their deaths without tears. Fine tales indeed, these, and the ones that follow them. Adultery seen so shamelessly in heaven among the gods that some even confess to envying those caught in it. For what else could be expected, when not even the eldest of them, their king, was able to restrain his impulse for union with his wife long enough even to reach their bedchamber? And then there are the gods who serve mankind, now building for hire, now herding flocks, others bound like criminals in a bronze dungeon. What sensible person would these not provoke to rebuke those who invented such tales and to condemn as great folly those who accepted them? And others still have fashioned dread and fear, and even madness and deceit. Indeed, what one of the worst passions have they not molded into the nature and form of God? And they have persuaded cities to sacrifice even to these, the more decently named among them. And so they find themselves under great necessity to regard some of the gods as givers of good things and to call others averters of evil, and then to buy these off with gifts and favors, just as they would the wickedest of men, expecting to suffer some great harm from them if they fail to pay the fee. What, then, is the cause of such great inconsistency and offense in matters divine? I myself suppose it is that their lawgivers, from the beginning, neither grasped the true nature of God, nor, so far as they were able to attain any accurate knowledge of it, made this the basis for the rest of the ordering of the Constitution, but left it, like any other trivial matter, to the poets to bring in whatever gods they pleased, suffering all things, and to the orators to enroll by decree of the people any foreign god that suited them. And painters and sculptors, too, enjoyed great license among the Greeks in this regard, each inventing some form of his own, one molding it from clay, another painting it. While those craftsmen most admired of all have ivory and gold at their disposal as material for their ever-fresh inventions. And some of the temples lie utterly deserted, while others are elaborately adorned with purifications of every kind. Then the gods who once flourished in honor have grown old. And those next below them in rank have been demoted to second place, for that is the more decent way to put it, while new ones, once introduced, receive their own cults, as in the digression from what we said before, we leave aside the places that have been left deserted. And some of the temples lie desolate while others are newly founded, each man establishing one according to his own private wish, when in fact they ought, on the contrary, to keep their belief about God and the honor due to him unchanging. Apollonius Malon, then, was one of the foolish and deluded. But those who truly philosophized among the Greeks were blind to none of what has been said, nor were they ignorant of the frigid pretexts of the allegories, and for that reason they rightly despised them, and came to agree with us on the true and fitting opinion about God. Starting from this, Plato says that none of the other poets should be admitted into his republic, and even Homer he dismisses with courtesy, crowning him and pouring myrrh over him, so that the right opinion about God should not be obscured by his myths. And Plato imitated our lawgiver most of all in this, that he prescribed no instruction for his citizens so important as that all should learn the laws exactly. And moreover, in the matter of not allowing outsiders to mingle in at random, he took care that the body of citizens should remain pure, made up only of those who abide by the laws. Of none of this did Malon Apollonius take account when he accused us of not admitting those who hold other preconceived opinions about God, and of being unwilling to associate with those who choose to live by a different way of life. But this too is not peculiar to us. It is common to everyone, not only to the Greeks, but also to those held in the highest repute among the Greeks. The Lacedaemonians regularly practiced the expulsion of foreigners and did not permit their own citizens to travel abroad, suspecting corruption of their laws from both directions. One might perhaps reasonably reproach them for harshness, since they shared neither their citizenship nor their way of life with anyone. We, however, while we do not think it right to imitate the ways of others, gladly welcome those who wish to share in our own. This, I think, would be evidence at once of humanity and of magnanimity. I will say no more about the Lacedaemonians, but how did the Athenians, who thought their city common to all, stand on these matters? Of this Apollonius was ignorant, that they punished without mercy even those who merely uttered a word against their laws concerning the gods. For what other reason did Socrates die? He certainly did not betray the city to its enemies, nor did he plunder any of the temples, but because he swore new oaths and claimed that some divine sign spoke to him, or, as some say, in jest, for this he was condemned to drink hemlock and die. His accuser also charged him with corrupting the young, in that he led them to despise their ancestral constitution and its laws. Thus Socrates, a citizen of Athens, endured such a punishment. Anaxagoras was a Clazomenian. But because, when the Athenians held the sun to be a god, he said it was a fiery molten mass, they condemned him to death by a narrow margin of votes. And on Diagoras of Milos, they set a price of 1 talent for anyone who should kill him, because he was said to mock the mysteries observed among them. And Protagoras, had he not fled in time, would have been seized and put to death for having, as they thought, written something inconsistent with what the Athenians believed about the gods. And why should one wonder that they treated men of such standing this way, when they did not even spare women? For they put to death a priestess, once someone accused her of initiating people into the worship of foreign gods, a thing forbidden by their law, which fixed a punishment against those who introduced a foreign god. Death is the penalty. Men who enforce such a law obviously did not think that other people's gods were gods at all, Otherwise, they would not have begrudged themselves the benefit of a larger pantheon. So much, then, for the Athenians. The Scythians, who delight in the murder of human beings and differ little from wild animals, nevertheless think they must guard their own customs jealously, and they killed Anacharsis, a man admired by the Greeks for his wisdom, when he returned to them, because he seemed to come back saturated with Greek habits. One could find many put to death among the Persians for the very same reason. But apparently Apollonius delighted in the laws of the Persians and admired them, because the Greeks profited from Persian courage, and from the unanimity the Persians held concerning the gods profited from that unanimity, at least, by burning down their temples, and very nearly became slaves in return for their courage. Yet he became an imitator of every Persian practice, violating other men's wives and castrating boys. Among us, death is fixed as the penalty even if a man wrongs an irrational animal in that way. Neither fear of our conquerors nor rivalry with the practices honored among other nations has ever had the strength to draw us away from these laws of ours. Nor have we cultivated courage for the sake of waging wars for the sake of greed, but for the sake of preserving our laws. Other losses we endure mildly, but whenever anyone forces us to move our institutions, then we choose war even beyond our strength, and hold out under disaster to the very last extremity. Why, indeed, should we envy the laws of others when we see that they are not kept even by the very people who established them? How could the Spartans not condemn their own exclusive constitution and their carelessness about marriage? How could the Eleans and Thebans not condemn their union with males, against nature, and without any restraint? Practices they once supposed most admirable and most advantageous, they have not entirely abandoned indeed, yet they no longer admit to them. Rather, they swear off the very laws concerning them, laws that once held such power among the Greeks that they even attributed unions between males to the gods, and by the same reasoning marriages between full brothers and sisters, composing this as their defense of unnatural and monstrous pleasures. I set aside for now speaking of the punishments, how many releases most lawgivers from the beginning granted the wicked, legislating fines of money for adultery and marriage for seduction, and how many pretexts of denial are allowed regarding impiety, should anyone attempt to examine them. For among most peoples, it has already become a practiced skill to transgress the laws. Not so among us. Even if we are deprived of wealth, of cities, and of every other good thing, our law at least remains immortal for us, and no Jew, however far he might go from his homeland, and however much he might fear a harsh master, will fail to fear the law even before he fears that master. If then, it is because of the excellence of our laws that we are so disposed toward them, let our critics concede that we have the very best laws. But if they suppose that we cling so persistently to base laws, what would they themselves justly deserve, they who do not keep the better ones? Since long time is trusted as the truest judge of all things, I would make this my witness to the excellence of our lawgiver, and to the account of God that he handed down. For an immense span of time has passed, and if one should compare him to the ages of other lawgivers, one would find him to surpass them all. Indeed, our laws have been proven sound by us, and they have produced in all other men, always and increasingly, a zeal that outstrips their own. The first to do so were those among the Greeks who practiced philosophy. While seeming outwardly to preserve their ancestral ways, in their actual conduct, and in their philosophizing, they followed him, holding similar views about God and teaching frugality of life and fellowship with one another. Nor is this all. A great zeal for our piety has already spread for a long time even among the masses, and there is no city of the Greeks, none whatsoever, nor any nation of barbarians, where the custom of the seventh day, on which we rest, has not spread, and where our fasts and the kindling of lamps and many of our food restrictions are not observed. They also try to imitate our harmony with one another, our distribution of goods, our diligence in crafts, and our endurance under the compulsions imposed for the sake of our laws. For the most remarkable thing is this: our law has prevailed by itself, apart from any inducement of pleasure to draw men in, and just as God pervades the whole universe, so our law has made its way through all mankind. Let each man examine his own homeland and his own household, and he will not disbelieve what I have said. One must therefore condemn deliberate wickedness in all mankind, if they have set their desire on emulating what is foreign and base rather than what is their own and good. Or else they must stop slandering us out of envy. For we are not laying claim to anything that should provoke envy when we honor our own lawgiver and put our trust in what he prophesied concerning God. Even if we ourselves did not understand the excellence of our laws, we would still be led to think highly of them by the sheer number of those who emulate them. Concerning our laws and our constitution, I have given a precise account in my work on antiquities. Just now I have mentioned them only so far as was necessary, with no intention either of disparaging the institutions of others or of praising our own, but only so as to refute those who have written unjustly about us, men who have shamelessly quarreled with the plain truth itself. And now I think I have adequately fulfilled, through this account, what I promised at the outset. I have shown that our people is older in antiquity than our accusers claimed, who said it was very recent, and I have produced many ancient authors in their own writings who make mention of us, when our accusers insisted that not a single one exists. They also said our ancestors were Egyptians, yet it has been shown that they came into Egypt from elsewhere. They falsely claimed our ancestors were expelled because of bodily disease, yet it has been shown that they returned to their own land by choice and through abundance of strength. Some have reviled our lawgiver as the most worthless of men, but God, long ago, and after him time itself, has proven to be the witness of his virtue. Concerning the laws, no further discussion was needed, for they have been seen through their own operation teaching not impiety but the truest piety, calling men not to hatred of humanity, but to fellowship in what they possess, hostile to injustice, careful of righteousness, banishing idleness and extravagance, teaching self-sufficiency and industriousness, restraining wars waged for greed while preparing men to be courageous in defense of the laws themselves, unyielding in their punishments. Unmoved by clever pretexts of argument, forever confirmed by deeds, for these we always furnish more clearly than any written record could. I would therefore say with confidence that we have introduced to the rest of mankind a very great number of the noblest things together at once. For what is nobler than unwavering piety? What is more just than obedience to the laws? Or what is more advantageous than harmony with one another, neither breaking apart in misfortunes nor growing insolent and factious in good fortune, but in war holding death in contempt, and in peace devoting ourselves to crafts or farming, and being persuaded that in everything everywhere, God oversees and directs it all? If these things had been written earlier or kept more faithfully by others, we would owe them gratitude as having become their disciples. But if we are seen to make use of them more than anyone else, and if we have shown that their first discovery belongs to us, then let the Appians and the Malans and all who delight in lying and slander be refuted. And to you, Epaphroditus, who love the truth above all, and for your sake, so that those who likewise wish to know about our people may have it, let this book, along with the one before it, be written.